Hey, everybody. My name's Kent Thompson, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Kent.
It's good to be here. I tell you, Mother's Day is a big deal around our house, but, you know, I've got a wife and three kids, and somehow my wife rates being a mother to those three kids higher than she rates being married to a drunk like me. I haven't figured out how she figured that out, but that seems to be the way it is. And her mom's in town, and my mom's still in town, and but anyway, the deal is I'm of no use to any of those people unless I'm involved with Alcoholics Anonymous in a big way, and I accept that fully today. I'm in total bondage to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love it, you know. It's without it, I really wouldn't have a life worth living, in my opinion. I ran my own life for 46 years and ran it right in the gutter repeatedly, and be able to come in here and just really get involved in this thing and have a new life as a result of it has been a real miracle and a real blessing in my life. And so I'm more than happy to come up here on Mother's Day and share my experience, strength, and hope with you. And yeah, I grew up in Lunenburg County, which is a farming area. Our nearest neighbors were about a half mile in each direction. And we raised tobacco and acres of gardens, so I grew up with a good work ethic. You couldn't help it down there because nobody was going to let you out of work, so you may as well get used to it and learn how to do it, you know. And that wasn't our livelihood. My dad was a construction superintendent, and my mom worked in the post office. And but anyway, they kept me and my three brothers busy with this tobacco and all this other stuff we grew, and it looked like a pretty good life, you know. I know it was our family's intention when we went out in public, we were going to look like the perfect family, you know. Here's everybody's all dressed neatly and looking like they're supposed to be. But I think inside we all knew it was something wrong in our family, you know. My dad was a social drinker, the best I can remember. I used to work construction with him in the summers in high school and college, and on Friday afternoon, driving home, we'd always have a beer together, you know, and did a lot of hunting and stuff growing up, and we'd drink after that. We didn't go out there drunk during the day or anything like a good alcoholic would, but anyway, my mom, on the other hand, was just a raging alcoholic nutcase is the best way I can describe her, and I hate to say that, but that's just the way it was. But she didn't look like that to the outside world. She never missed a day's work due to her alcoholism. But every night when she got home, that gin would come out, and you got between her and it, between 6 o'clock and bedtime, you were probably going to go sailing across the room, because she was a big, powerful woman, and apparently a little angry about some things in life. So that's what alcoholism does to us. It really, really permeates the whole family, so today I've got three older brothers, and I hate to say it, but they're all just pretty miserable in life. None of them are alcoholic, but they're, you know, they've been trying to control things for so long and keep a lid on this thing and live by this family code, this unspoken family code we had. This is how we're going to deal with this thing, you know. Unfortunately, Kent didn't always get the code, you know, so I'd manage to get Mom fired up, you know, and then and she's on me, and then all the brothers are on me. Why did you do that? And get her wound up, you know, and on and on it went. So I don't know, like every alcoholic or every alcoholic I've ever heard, I felt like I had a hard time fitting into any kind of groups, a hard time, you know, having as many friends as I wanted to have at school and all that type stuff. And when I was 10 years old, my dad had gone with Mom to the S&H green stamp store where, you know, you buy gasoline or whatever, you get these green stamps, and then periodically you go to the green stamp store and trade them in for whatever. So he bought home this 100-pound weight set, and, you know, like a good alcoholic, once I got an interest in something, I was gone with it. I set these things up in the stable and got the chart out that came with it. And this was when I was 10 years old. And by the time I was 16, I looked like Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know. And I think the thing that drove me to do it is, you know, I didn't look angry when I was out in public, but underneath this facade I put up, I was an angry kid, you know, from all this craziness I lived in. And Yeah, just I'd be in there just pumping iron and just thinking, if that guy Joey says something to me at school today, I'm going to kick his butt, you know. And that's how I went through life. I didn't really go in there looking to fit in. I was going to fit in under my terms, or I was going to stay off to myself and be happy doing that, one or the other. And so this went on, and this feeling of difference kind of stuck with me. My drinking really didn't get kicked off too early in life. I can remember a couple of little episodes, like one day we finished tobacco, and I couldn't have been more than, 8 or 10 years old, and the guys were drinking Old Milwaukee after we'd gotten all the tobacco in the barn, and they said, here, kid, take a few sips of this. One of my brother's friends did, you know, and I started drinking this thing pretty fast, and they all laugh and go, hey, you better slow up or you're going to be falling out here. And so that laughing at Kent drinking was something that went on for about 30 years. Yeah, I get pretty drunk, and when I started drinking, it was like lighting a rocket. I didn't know how far I was going to go, and I didn't really have a steering wheel on it. It was just going, and I was along for the ride, and wherever it ended up, and whatever I ran over along the way is just what happened. And so anyway, I get on into high school, and I'm still not drinking much. Like I said, a couple of episodes here and there. I ran football and played track, and that was my big stuff, being on the team and being with the guys on the, a few of the guys on the team and whatnot. And but then, towards the end of high school, I did start drinking, and I drank, I drank to get drunk when I drank, and but I always knew what was going to happen to me at home if I crashed a car or got a ticket or whatever. So I never got a DUI. And when I think of the times in my life I've driven drunk, the only way I can explain not getting a DUI is poor police work. I mean, there's no way you should be able to drive that many miles as drunk as I drove them and get away with it, but I did. And so anyway, it's mostly just a little weekend drinking, and I didn't think anything of it. But in the 11th grade, this tire blew up in my face and blew all this gunk in both eyes. And anyway, I ended up having a corneal transplant in one eye. And but for a year, between the thing blowing up and them getting it stabilized and me going back 2 years later to get this corneal transplant, I had to wear this like skin patch over one eye type thing, and it slowly dissolved, but it was still, I was a pretty hideous looking creature in high school, I tell you, and just added to that feeling of being different, being apart from, that I had, you know. And so I got a little kind of depressed about this whole eye thing. I was in Johns Hopkins in Baltimore that whole summer. I literally didn't see the outside that whole summer that year, and so I get back and my grades start slipping, and they slipped pretty badly my junior and senior years. I mean, I got through when I graduated, and so here's all my friends or anybody I was close to in high school going off to this college and that college, and I couldn't get into any of them, so I end up going to a community college, and that's where I started a pattern that went on for years in my life. When stuff would finally get bad enough, it's like I wouldn't realize it when I'm getting my first D in algebra or whatever. That was no big deal, you know. I could get on through that. But when I got to where I wouldn't accept it to the similar colleges as my buddies was going to, suddenly it's like, wham, that wakes me up, you know. And I'm in this community college, and I basically make straight A's in the thing because my goal was to get out of there and get to another school and get away from this crazy family I'm living with. And so that's what I did. Basically, my drinking's getting a little bit worse, but still no big consequences coming from it. Still keeping it to the weekends for the most part, maybe a little bit after school here and there. But again, when I drink, I'm getting drunk, you know. I'm not just going out to have one or two beers, but wake up with a hangover, and that's about the worst of it. Dented up Mom's car a little bit, but yeah, clever alcoholic I am. I came up with something to explain that, and it wasn't any big deal. It goes on, and so I get away, and then I got into Virginia Tech, and I head up there. And first semester, I got this roommate that flew out from Arizona, and we hooked up the day before classes started, and we're living in this apartment, and he's studying engineering, and I'm studying business, and Yeah, this whole thing of how I end up there just explains alcoholism to me. You know, if you got a chance to go to school, it seems like you'd sit down and say, this is a career I want to have. This is a course I need to take to get into that career, or something along those lines. I said, well, my older brother graduated from there last year. I can go take over his apartment. That's where I'm going. And so off I go. And so first semester, me and my roommate hunkered down, and we're making really good grades, and that went pretty good. And I said, well, this is going to be okay, you know. And then a bad thing happened. We were doing laundry. We both decided to hang up there a while during spring break, and we were doing laundry, and all these rolling papers come out in Mike's laundry. And I said, well, here's a guy I've got something in common with, you know. Apparently he likes to party. So the next semester, we once we find out we've got, you know, we've got a couple of alcoholics on the hook here, we come up with some kind of drinking thing for every night. We didn't set out to do that. That's just what we did. So Monday night was Monday night football. We'd go get as many of the tall Budweisers as we could and load up on those before the game started. And Tuesday night, we're out to some happy hour, wherever, Wednesday night. And another guy went to high school that ended up there. He said, I found the neatest organization. He said, you've got to come join this thing. You won't believe it. And it was the Tech Cave Club. And, you know, you explore caves and just a wild bunch of guys, you know. We did everything, skydiving, caving, repelling giant bridges we weren't supposed to be on and everything else, you know. But we were sober when we did that stuff, but as soon as the trip was complete, or as soon as we'd gotten down from the microwave tower or whatever we weren't supposed to be on, we start popping the beer tops, you know, and off we go. And every Friday night we'd have our cave club business meeting. I guess our business was monkey business, the best I could tell, because after the meeting, we'd have the party, and then the next day, you go caving, and then you get out of the cave, and you start a party that night, and that goes on through Saturday night, and then Sunday morning, you get up, and I was one of the guys that was going to really fulfill my role in this thing, so I helped them kill whatever kegs and liquor were left over Sunday morning, and then we taper off and get ready to go to class on Monday, you know, and so that went on, and suddenly I'm getting letters from the dean saying I may not be welcome back if I don't improve. And here's where my pattern kicks in. Okay, that was fun. I didn't see the bad thing coming, but it looks like a bad thing is here. I better knuckle down. So for the next couple of quarters, I'd knuckle down and make good grades, you know. And as soon as the heat was off, I'm back into the drinking and everything. And so that pattern went on, and finally in 83, I get out with a degree in economics, which if you can manage to squander 5 years on getting an econ degree, you might have some alcoholism somewhere in your background. I mean, it couldn't be a more worthless degree at the, you know, I suppose if you get a master's or PhD in it, you got something, but to mess around 5 years getting a bachelor's in econ, yeah, it takes an alcoholic to do that, I think. So I get out, and you got a little bit of a recession going on in 83, and I really can't find anything I want to do for work, and I said, well, the problem is that econ degree. If I just studied accounting or something, or computers, and really applied myself, I'd have been okay. But anyway, I get a couple of odd jobs, and I'm working, and one of them, I manage this office for a basement waterproofing company up in Washington, D.C. I'm sitting in there the first couple of weeks, and nothing's happening, you know. I get 6 or 8 phone calls a day, and I assign a salesman to go talk to these people, and I'm like, yeah, this isn't too bad. I can get drunk at night and do this job every day with no trouble. And then the flood hit. It rained for like 3 weeks nonstop, and then it snowed at the end of that, and suddenly we're getting 200 calls a day or more than I can answer, you know. And they're just coming in, and the salesmen are getting a little upset with me because I'm not laying out the best course for them to go see these people and all this, and this is just one of these alcoholic things I do. One day I just said, screw it. If they don't like the job I'm doing and they ain't going to give me any help taking all these calls coming in here, I'm leaving. And I got in the truck and left. And I didn't say goodbye to the owner, his son, or anybody. I'm just gone, you know. And I get back to my apartment and the son calls me up. He goes, you got to come back, man. We just took us forever to find somebody to hire, blah, 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 blah. I said, well, you should have thought about that when you didn't give me any training. It was always somebody else's fault, you know. They didn't train me right, or they didn't put me working with the right people or whatever. But tried a couple of other jobs, and they were no better. I said, man, I'm going to go back and get another degree. It's this lack of education is killing me. So I go back and didn't have good enough grades to get into graduate school and get a master's degree. So I go back to Tech, and they say, well, you can get a finance degree in 1 year. So that's what I did, and I went back and take all these courses. And again, now the heat's on me, you know. I found out it's rough out there in the real world, so I hunker down and make this dean's list every time, and I get a degree in finance, and get a job with a little consulting company down in Chester, Virginia, and they're flying me all over the country. Basically, we're counting chickens. We go to Tyson and Purdue and wherever, and we say, yeah, we look at your feed mill, your plant, your sales, the whole operation, and say, yeah, you can save a quarter cent on a pound of chicken here. And when you're doing 2 billion pounds of chicken a year, that's a lot of money. So typical pattern I went through. It took me a while to get a grasp on doing these audits, you know, and I was just slow as dirt doing them, and it just killed me to finish one, you know. And so the VP calls me in his office. He says, Kent, we've seen guys like you before that just had a hard time picking this stuff up, and we're going to have to fire you if you don't get faster in the next couple of rounds. And I'm like, whoa, the heat is on. So I knuckle down, and next thing you know, I'm flying on through these things. I end up doing the first computerized audit in the history of the company and saving them untold thousands of dollars because we're no longer flying all over the place. We get people to mail diskettes to us, and we put them in the laptops and do the reports, and we still had to go back and meet with the management. And I got trained up quicker than anybody in the history of the company to go back to management and present these reports. So that's what I was capable of doing, but I could never just do this stuff, you know, the way a normal person can get in an organization and say, what am I going to contribute to this organization, and just work, and up they go. And I get in there and say, Joe's got a better job than I do. So-and-so's doing this. I want to do that. And there I go into the ground, you know. And so anyway, they get me all trained up, and then they want to give me a promotion, and suddenly they're beneath me, you know. The only job I could get out of school, and now they want to give me a promotion, and suddenly they're beneath me. I'm like, well, I'm tired of this chicken-counting job anyway. And besides, I'm thinking about going back to school so I can get a real job, you know. And just traveling all over the place, that was a riot. Most companies that do audits, you travel in audit teams, but they send us out just one guy to northern Alabama or Atlanta or wherever, you know, and we're down there by ourselves. But I had an amazing knack for finding the alcoholics in these chicken companies, you know. I'd either find one and we'd go out after work and just get plastered, or if I couldn't do that, I'd sit in my hotel room and just drink warm beer. I used to ice it down. I get tired of fetching ice for all this beer, so I started drinking the beer warm, and I'm there with my laptop and guzzling beers, and I'm working away at these audits, and I'd finish up on Thursday and go home a day early so I didn't have to stay in, you know, Tupelo, Mississippi till Friday night finishing this thing. So anyway, I leave that company and go interview at a bigger company, and, you know, it's just really a stuffed shirt company. It's owned by a Swedish company. Everybody there is wearing three-piece suits, and it was like oil and water when I hit that thing. And why they hired me is a mystery to me. Why I accepted it is not a mystery. That's just alcoholism. Why would you go force your way into an organization that you ought to just look at and know, I really shouldn't try to work here. I'm not going to fit in with these people, you know. But in there I went, and while I was in there, I fulfilled my big goal. I went back to school over the course of 4 years and got an MBA going to night school. And but I'm in there, and I was never at ease from the first day in the door till 7 years later when they fired me. I was always ill at ease in that place. Always simultaneously felt better than those people because I was harder working than them, you know. I was, even though they had degrees from better schools and better work experience, I was smarter than them and had better ideas. And on the other hand, I always felt inferior to them. Like, God, they just look so at ease, you know. And I could not feel that way, and I could not fit in there. And I was always just in angst, you know, what's going to happen to me here next? And so they reorganized the organization, and they do away with my department. Or they're getting ready to do away with it, which was financial planning. We put the annual plan and everything together, and they said, we're going to roll that into accounting and do away with this four-person group. So a buddy of mine, it worked his way over into sales. So I go running over there and say, Robert, you got to make a job for me. They're getting ready to do away with my department over here. And I hounded him every day for months, you know, about 3 or 4 months over this thing. And finally he says, Ken, I got him to approve a position for you over here. So off I go to work in, as a sales analyst under Robert. And I repaid him the only way I knew how. A year later, I went to the VP of sales, and I said, you know, Robert really doesn't know how to use a guy like me. I said, he's just totally underutilizing me. I could be doing all sorts of stuff, and he's got me doing these little mundane reports, and, man, we just need to do something different here. So he moved me over to work under another guy, and man, that was a story. This guy ends up that he's alcoholic, and he has to get up in front of the whole corporate office of 250 people and say, I'm an alcoholic. And that was the only way he could keep his job, because he's coming in with liquor on his breath every day, you know. And I'm in my late 20s at this point, early 30s maybe. And I'm going, man, what a disgusting human being to come to work with liquor on his breath. Who in God's name would do that? They should kick him out. Why do they keep giving him another chance, you know? And that's really what I thought about it. I thought the same thing when I'm working construction in the summers. I see these carpenters, and there'd always be one or two of them that'd come in drunk, you know, and couldn't walk on the beams up there because they're going to fall off. And hanging out in the wherever, drinking beer at lunchtime, you know. And I said, man, that is just some disgusting people that would come drink on the job. So anyway, it goes on, and we keep going through these reorganizations. And so, like, a bunch of people get promoted, and they come to me, and they say, Kent, we want to move you over into marketing, but since you've never worked there before, we don't want to promote you right away. We want you to do the job for 6 months, and if you do well, then we'll look at giving you a promotion, you know. Which made perfect business sense. Here's a guy that, you know, hadn't done the job before. We're going to see how he does it before we go spending a lot of time and money and corporate resources on, you know, see what he's going to do over here first. But, man, that thing ate me up. I mean, I was so afraid I wasn't going to do well. You know, just total fear. I couldn't see this thing until I got into AA and did my fourth step. But just total fear-driven. And, you know, the guy that came and gave me the news, I talk about him like a dog every chance I got, and whatever. But but this thing's just burning me up for no reason. And finally, one day, I'm going out to lunch late, and he's coming back in from lunch, and he says, good afternoon, Kent. And I said, F you, Phil. Well, this is the guy that signs my check every 2 weeks, you know. So now I look at it, and I understand that that's alcoholism, you know. All this stuff we do drunk is bad enough, but we don't do much better sober. That's alcoholism. And so anyway, Phil, being the clever guy he is, figured a way to get me out of there about 2 months later. And so then I'm back out looking for a job, and I said, well, I'm kind of disillusioned with this whole corporate thing. I need something I can do on my own, you know. And so I look at real estate, and that's pretty easy to get into. So I get a real estate license. The last thing I ever wanted to be was a salesperson, but here's something easy to get into, so I'm going to give it a try. So when I get in there and I'm self-employed, suddenly all this idea of drinking during the day is not as bad as I thought it was. In fact, you know, dealing with these crazy people in real estate, the other agents, and people wanted to buying and selling houses, and the whole thing was just kind of nuts to a guy that can't get along with people. I'm having to get up and intoxicate myself a bit in the morning to start the day, and then during the day, you know, some days I'd make it through okay, but most I just pretty much had to stay drunk to get through them, you know. And tough to make a living when you're doing that. I mean, I did it because I had that alcoholic drive, you know, the first couple of years in it, I'd knock on 500 doors a week, you know. Just literally knock on them, hey, when are you planning on moving? And give them a piece, give them a flyer. And suddenly I've taken over a couple of neighborhoods, you know, and I'm selling stuff and probably in the top 5% of agents in Richmond, you know. And so that's what we alcoholics tend to do. We build stuff up and then we watch it come tumbling down. And that's what happened with me. So eventually it's getting to where I can only stay sober a couple of hours to get to my critical appointments. If you want to buy a house right now or if you want to list your house to sell right now, I can get there with the paperwork. If you've got a question 10 minutes after I've driven away, good luck, because I ain't answering the phone. I can't deal with how I feel from having all this interaction with you, and I've got to numb myself to those feelings, and off I go. So this is going on, and meanwhile, a bad thing happened. I found out I was a type 1 diabetic, and this was in 1989. And first, I didn't believe it, you know. So we've got I call him a jack-in-the-box, a doc-in-the-box, you know. You go in there, and I'd gotten a physical to do something, and the guy comes walking in the room. Well, how long have you been diabetic? I said, are you talking to me? I've never been diabetic. Yeah, I said, he doesn't know what he's talking about, so I go out and order a couple of Big Macs and whatever to prove to this guy that I can eat what I want to. And, but anyway, I end up going down to MCV and meeting with an endocrinologist. He goes, oh, yeah, it's no question you're diabetic. You need to start on insulin right away, you know. And no family history of it or anything. And so anyway, I'm discussing, you know, the whole diabetic lifestyle with him, and I'm getting ready to hop down off the table. And he goes, and by the way, if I were you, I wouldn't drink anymore. And I stop in midair, hopping off the table. What did you say? I said, you mean don't drink any? He said, yeah, I really wouldn't if I were you. Maybe, you know, one drink here or there isn't going to kill you, but I'd just stay away from it. The calories in it drive your blood sugar up, and then there's some can also affect your liver, which drives your blood sugar down, and it's just bad stuff, you know. You could be passing out from it or whatever. And so anyway, I left his office a little bit depressed because by this time I'm living in Richmond and, well, been in Richmond, but, you know, I'm out drinking basically every night with buddies of mine at different bars around town. And I mean, just getting plastered, you know. Around about 1 o'clock, we'd go in the last bars open or back on the way home and drink 3 or 4 Long Island iced teas this big, you know, and God knows how I got back home every night, but I managed to do it. And so anyway, I get the word that the drinking has got to go, and so I'm a little bit depressed about it. So what I found out is great minds think alike, because I went around town to all, you know, I'm married, and I've got one kid at this point, and but when I really want to party, go out and do some drinking and drugs, I go and get a few single friends that live around town, divorced or whatever, and I go to their house and live it up on Saturday, and that's how I get by, you know. And then I can drink a little bit at home, but I can't really get plastered the way I like to. So I'm drinking a little bit at home and then hitting these guys' houses and hang out over there, you know, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 hours on Saturday. And that's how I got by. So I go to their different houses and I say, well, I've gotten the bad news here. I can't drink anymore. I'm diabetic. And every one of them came up with the same thing. They said, Ken, it's no big deal. Just smoke marijuana. So anyway, here I am. And one guy said, yeah, I take it with me everywhere I go, you know. I said, well, these people are much smarter than that doctor down at MCD I'm talking to. Of course, it's all part of the delusion we live in. I mean, what does a diabetic pothead do when he gets some munches? You going to eat a handful of lettuce? I mean, I'm plowing down Doritos and cheeseburgers like every other pothead, and it's just driving my blood sugar through the roof, but I haven't started to have any real complications from it, so like everything else, I'm able to pretend it's not a problem, you know? And I go on like that, and man, the obsession for using this stuff is almost became almost indescribable at some point. It was like everything else. I'd come up with methods to try to control it. I'd get the stuff and I'd put it in 2 or 3 baggies and tape those up and stick them in a jar, and I'd duct tape the lid on the jar, and then I put the jar in a little locking chest thing I had and put a lock on that, and then I take it out to my tool shed and I throw it and I cover it up with chains and jacks and whatnot, and then I lock the door, and then, and this is Wednesday afternoon, right? And I'm like, all right, I'm going to go to work now. And I get back in the house, and I say, yeah, I won't do that again until Saturday. And then I'm thinking about it, and I'm thinking about it. I said, well, Friday night wouldn't be too bad. I'd go there Friday night. That wouldn't hurt anything. I go, Jesus, I got to get out there and make sure that stuff's okay. So I go out there, and I tear through all these locks and stuff in about 2 minutes. And I get that stuff, and I put it in my pocket. And I'm like, phew, man, what was I thinking? I'm not going to smoke it. I'm just going to have it here in case I need to smoke it. Off I go, and you know the rest. It got smoked. Another day. So finally it got to where I'd smoke this stuff, and it get to where I couldn't get any effect of it after about a day and a half. I'd done so much. And I hate myself. I literally hate my guts. I hate everything about my life. I say, how can I be this damn disgusting, you know? I'm going to get rid of this forever. And I throw it out the window going down the road. And 4 hours later, I go pick it up and start on it again. I said, well, I'm smart enough to figure this out. I won't throw a whole bag out. I'll just sprinkle it out the window. And that's what I would do. I get to start hating myself. I'm going to quit forever. I sprinkle it out the window. The next day, I go back, and I got a flashlight this big, and I'm out here at 12 o'clock because the weeds cast shadows out there, you know. I'm out in the bright sunlight with this flashlight on the side of fairly busy roads looking to reclaim this stuff, you know. And one day I'd been down to visit my mom in Lunenburg, and, you know, it's Monday morning. I got a to-do list this long of stuff I've got to get done at work today, and I have every intention of doing it, every intention of doing it. And the night before, coming back from mom's, of course, I couldn't be around that crazy woman without being intoxicated, so I'd sprinkled a bag out the other side of Blackstone. So anyway, I'm headed to work, and next thing I know, the car has made a right turn onto the expressway, and it's going 70 miles an hour to Blackstone. And, you know, hour and 20 minutes away, whatever it was, I'm down by this farmer's field looking for the stuff. And I mean, I had the idea. I said, this isn't right, you know, but it didn't bother me too long, especially if I found any of it. So I come on back to town, and towards the end of it, I got really sick. I had a couple of friends that keep a lot of it stored around, and I'd go break in their house and get it, you know. And here I am, one of the top real estate agents. I had a moment of clarity one day. This one friend of mine had quite a party house, you know. All the guys would go over, all the guys and all the married guys in my boat would go over to his house on the weekend to party with him. Call it party, and I don't know what you'd call it when it gets that compulsive. It ain't partying, that's for sure. And so toward the end, he decides he needs to deter people a little bit because it's just a constant stream of people coming to his front door like flies to honey, you know. And so he starts buying all these guns, and you're sitting there, and he'd be pointing a gun at you while you're smoking or whatever. I'm like, oh, easy, man. And then he starts buying snakes, and I hate a snake. Hated them ever since I was a kid. Well, if you want some, you got to handle this snake. I'm like, give him here. You want me to kiss him or what? So he was one of the guys I started breaking in his house, you know. And he had a 9-foot privacy fence, and I'd pull a super can up to that thing, and I'd hop over in about 3 seconds, and two dogs, but they knew me because I was over so much, so that wasn't any problem. And I put a 5-gallon bucket up and push his window open. He didn't have locked, and jump in there and ramble around, and I can hear these snakes under the, like a little path going through each room, and the rest of it's all trash covered, you know, and cardboard and mess, and I can hear these snakes creeping around in there, and I'm looking under it to find what I can find. And one day I'm coming back out, and I'm standing in the windowsill, and, you know, I'm a guy that's got a key to 6,000 houses in Richmond, you know. I say, man, this just isn't right, you know, that I've got this job, and yeah, I'm over here violating somebody's property like this, and what's wrong with me? And again, you know, the thought goes away quickly enough. And so off I go, and at that time, a friend of mine had gotten into AA, and he said, Kent, you might want to consider AA. I didn't know what alcoholism was. I didn't know what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I didn't didn't understand any of it. All I knew is my whole life, my parents, my teachers, everybody that had ever mentored me had said, if you had a problem, work harder. If you have a problem, work smarter. If you, you know, handle your problems, take care of stuff, you know. And I was convinced I had willpower to burn and I was going to get a handle on this thing. And plus, I wasn't sure when it became a problem anyway, because for 20 years it was my solution to life. So the fact it wasn't working now was almost inconceivable. The fact it was a problem, it wasn't a problem to me. If you had a problem with it, that was your problem. So anyway, here I am. Here I am at an AA meeting all of a sudden, and it was quite eye-opening. I'm looking around. I'm going, wow, there are people just like me that have the same problem I do. You know, they can't get a handle on this stuff either. Of course, a lot of them did have a handle on it, and you know, the thing that threw me was they had all these DUIs, and their families were split up, and they didn't have jobs, and I didn't have any of that stuff. I still had my family. I'd lost a ton of opportunity in my work, but I was still doing okay in it. Never gotten a DUI despite my best efforts. Never been to treatment. So anyway, I just couldn't grasp the thing. I didn't believe the basic concepts of it. I didn't believe I was powerless over anything. At the time, I was a big bicyclist. I could bicycle 60 or 100 miles if I wanted to. So when you said alcohol's fatal, I couldn't believe it. I said, well, it might kill you, but it ain't going to kill me. And I just couldn't believe, you know, just couldn't believe it. But I knew I needed something in my life. So while I was in there, I never could stay continuously sober. I'd get 30 days or maybe 40 days, and I was sober more days than I was not sober. But I could not stay continuously sober because I never did the things we have to do in AA to get sober, which is to do the 12 steps of this program, to get active in a home group and carry the message, and just to be a part of it and get involved in the unity and fellowship of it. And I didn't do any of that stuff. I just wanted to go to meetings and get better. And I went to 5 or 6 meetings a week for 2 years, and I got a little better, but I was still just uneasy. When I was sober, this fear, angst, resentment towards people, all this stuff would just start eating me up inside and just get louder and louder. And then I'd go drink and it'd be just like pouring water on a fire, you know. It's like, all right, everything's okay again. Now I got to get ready and go to some AA meetings tomorrow, you know. So anyway, I knew I needed to keep trying, but at the end of 2 years, I said, something's got to go. Either I got to quit drinking or I got to quit this AA stuff. And I gave it 2 minutes of serious consideration, and I said, I don't need AA anymore. And I was back out on my own, going to handle it on my own again. So I tried these, you know, I'm only going to do this much a day. I'm only going to do this, whatever. Of course, none of it would work for any period of time. And so anyway, I'm in there and I'm back out, and some stuff started happening to me. My son took karate over in the, and I had to go take him over to karate lessons, and, you know, couldn't be a normal dad and sit there and watch a kid do karate for an hour. Had to drive up and down Broad Street in Richmond and smoke a joint, you know. So one day I'm out smoking, and I've got a new stash, and the stuff was a lot more potent than I expected it to be, and it's like knocking me for a loop, you know. I can barely keep my car in the road. And I went, wow, I can't go pick him up. This messed up, you know. I got to sober up a little bit, and I turn and go down another road, and I'm looking at my speedometer, and then I hear this screaming, and there's a homeless guy on a bicycle about this far from the front of my car, and I managed to swerve and miss him by 3 inches, and that's when it hit me. I said, man, alcohol is fatal. If it doesn't kill me, it's going to kill somebody. And that's when it started thinking, you know, maybe I need to go give this thing another try. But that still wasn't quite enough. I had a friend of mine that bought a house and had a housewarming party, and I went over there, and I hadn't done much drinking, and, you know, when you've got a sufficient substitute for alcohol, you don't need the alcohol quite as much. As long as we can get out of reality, we're okay. But I go over there, and this girl has a keg, and I start drinking this beer, and it felt like coming across a desert, you know, and hitting an oasis or a water stand after about a week in the desert. And I'm drinking these things, and they're just going down faster than water, you know. And I don't know how many I had. It was up in the 20s easily, these big plastic cups. And last thing I remember is trying to keep one foot in the other to keep from falling over as I'm heading toward my car. And don't remember anything from then. I lived about 20 minutes away. Don't remember anything about driving home, getting in bed or anything. Next thing I know, it's about 4 in the morning. My wife's yelling at me, "Why do you reek of alcohol, you know? What did you do?" And anyway, so that was another thing that kind of hit me. It says, things aren't going well. I can't do it on my own. But the last thing was this. I was putting in a patio behind my house, and my neighbor, he likes to, you know, go around and be involved with everybody and see what they're doing. And I'm out here working with the patio, with these guys on the patio, and here comes Don, you know, and he says, "Kent, what are you doing?" And I should have been able to answer the question in about 5 words. "Don, we're putting in a patio." But I'm all messed up, you know, and I start telling him, "Don, we're doing and this is why it goes, this is why this." And about 6 minutes into my explanation, he just looks at me and goes, "Kent, if you didn't smoke so much dope, you'd make a lot more sense." I said, "Oh, Jesus, the neighbors are on to me, you know." I didn't know anybody knew. I thought I had this thing well hidden. And that was the final straw. I said, "Man, I got to get back into AA." So I head back in the house. Well, it was actually the next day. I'm feeling okay. And, well, I'm kind of baffled. I'm like, well, I got to get back into AA. And well, I started looking up the phone number of this guy I'd met before I went out. And I knew I wanted him to sponsor me, you know. And while I'm looking it up, this unconscious thing that controls me as much as my conscious thinking starts kicking in again. It goes, "Maybe I can do this just enough to get by, you know. Maybe I can just get the heat off of me, get my wife to settle down, use less like I did last time I was in AA." And I'm thinking about it, and this time I got a different set of answers, and they didn't come from me. I don't know where they came from, but thank God I got them. And said, "No, you can't do it anymore. It doesn't work with your wife. It doesn't work with your kids. It doesn't work with your work. It doesn't work with anything." And I just said out loud, "I'm done." And when I said it, this warm feeling just hit me, and it like started in my head and went through my whole body, and it was only about 6 or 8 seconds. But and then after that finished, my new sponsor is on the phone, and he says, "Well, Ken, you probably need to meet and talk about this sponsorship deal and see if you really want to do it and talk about what's involved." And I said, "No, Mark, I'm ready to go. Let's just get started." And so anyway, off we went. And so having had a few false starts on my step work, I was able to, pretty familiar with it, and I quit trying to figure it out. You know, it used to be I had to figure out everything. I had to understand it, and this time I wasn't going to understand it. I was just going to do it, you know. Whatever this guy said, I was going to do. And in 3.5 months, I was through my step work, except the stuff that goes on forever, which is my nice step amends, being a better dad, being a better husband, contributing to my industry instead of breaking in people's houses and all that stuff. And then my 12th step, well, 10, 11, and 12, the maintenance steps, you know, if we don't do that, what I've seen now that I've been around a little while is all you got to do is step away from AA and this miracle that got us sober will leave us, you know. We'll start, all that crazy thinking and fear and resentment will start coming back on us. The next thing you know, if we stay away long enough, we'll be drunk. That's just the way it is. And so anyway, I just got active, and fortunately, I got into a fantastic sponsorship chain, and they're just like, really, once you recover, he says, "Okay, now you're going to work." And I go, "Going to work? What do you mean? I came here to see what I could get sober, you know, feel better." He says, "Yeah, the answer's out there, you know." So off we go to Rubicon, and it's been one thing after another since, where our home group is organized around service committees. Everybody that's active in the home group is on one or all of these committees, which are treatment, corrections, newcomers, and cooperation with professionals. And if you look back at AA history and what Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob Smith did, that's exactly what they did. They did CPC work, going to doctors and psychiatrists and nurses and clergymen and whoever that comes into contact with drunks and saying, hey, this is how we can help these people, and this is how you can make an effective referral to AA. So we do that stuff. And treatment, we go to got a giant treatment center called the Healing Place that keeps about 200 or 225 guys. And we go in there every Monday night and present, rotate through six topics. This is what AA is. This is what sponsorship in a home group is. This is how you can keep sober long term once you get out of treatment. And then we go into a hospital's detox unit every Saturday night and talk to the people in there. We give them a card with our name and number on it. If you're getting out soon, give us a call and we'll hook you up with AA, you know. And then we've just started a thing a couple of months ago in City Jail, and I've been in there every Wednesday night. And we just go in there and same type thing we're doing in the treatment center. We're not trying to carry a meeting in there. I don't think you can do AA so much in some of these environments, but you can learn what it is and what you're going to have to do when you get out. And that's our goal when we go in there. And so we work on that stuff. And to me, that's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I do that stuff, like good things start to happen to me. I focus on carrying the message, and the God of my understanding takes care of all this stuff I used to burn up infinite energy trying to take care of and doing just a horrible job at, you know. I focus on carrying the message. I truly make it my primary purpose. So in order to do that, there are no divisions in my day anymore. You know, I'll take a couple of real estate calls and I'll talk to a sponsee, or I'll talk to my sponsor, or I'll talk to the treatment guy about what we want to get, what we need to work up for the next treatment meeting or whatever, you know, and then back to work. And then, you know, it used to be meetings were a one-hour event or one-hour and two-minute event for me, if I could keep them that short, and get there at the last minute when the final prayer was said, get out, and off I was gone. And I was going to keep AA up here, and I was going to keep the rest of my life running along like it was supposed to, you know. And my experience is it absolutely won't work that way, you know. Until I get involved in carrying the message the way we do it, my recovery is just not going to be what it ought to look like, you know. So that's what we do, and yeah, it's been amazing. You know, I've had a number of positions in my home group, and I've really become a cog in the wheel. I've got that group is, you know, they'll go on without me, but as it is, they are dependent on the stuff I do, you know. And between that and carrying the message, I've gotten the peace that I always was looking for in the world, you know. I can go pretty much anywhere and be comfortable and just do what I'm supposed to do, and just be happy doing the things that, you know, you would naturally do in whatever role it is, whether it's helping your kids with homework or, you know, being more service-oriented towards your customers instead of hoping they won't ask you to do another thing, or, you know, helping my wife solve a problem instead of being too messed up for her to even consider asking me to help or whatever it is, you know. It's just all, it's all come together in a pretty amazing way, and I know as long as I keep doing this stuff, it should keep happening that way. And, yeah, it's been good. And, yeah, I think that's the deal, you know. We don't, to me, AA is a program of resurrection. I can't come in here and have my old life and have it normal. I was never normal. If I was normal, I wouldn't have been an alcoholic, you know. We're born with characteristics, you know. We're impatient people. We have a big view of the world. I never had a moment's interest in anything ordinary, whether it was women or cars or jobs or whatever it was, you know. Very sensitive people, like that whole job thing I described, wouldn't bother the normal person, but an alcoholic, it eats them alive till they do something really dumb. So, yeah, we're born with this stuff, and then we drink enough to kick off the physical aspects of it, and we're in rough shape till we find a solution to it. And today I understand perfectly, without any doubt, we have a fatal progressive disease. If I don't do something about this thing, I will die. There's no question in my mind. And, you know, this whole diabetes thing, there's no history of it in my family. And if you read up on it, alcoholism is one way people get it, you know. And so here I am, had destroyed a major organ in my body, and yet I can't admit I'm alcoholic, can't admit I'm powerless over this thing. And unfortunately, that's part of our disease, too, is living in this delusion. And until we snap into reality, which to me is surrender, until I surrender, I say, yeah, this is where my life is, and I've got to take some steps if I want to move forward and get it better. And when we're able to come in here and do that stuff, we're on our way. And that's all I've got. Thanks for letting me speak.